point. And issues affecting the African-American.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Post-affirmative action, post-remedial education. Just who is going back to school this month? Today on Democracy Now!, Berkeley and Manhattan students talk about what's different about the entering class of 1998. Plus, a report from Amy Goodman on the prospects for people-driven democracy in Nigeria and the future of public access TV, those channels that claim to be TV's last home for real free speech. They're up for refranchising around the country. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, what Amy Goodman would call the exception to the rule. Amy's on assignment in Nigeria. We're going to hear from her in just a moment. Sitting in for her, I'm Laura Flanders. In the headlines this morning, President Clinton is heading to Moscow today for a summit with Boris Yeltsin. The Russian president spent the weekend trying to cut a deal with political opponents that will let him continue to govern. Meanwhile, Clinton's aides acknowledge that with Russia in economic turmoil and Yeltsin's cabinet in flux, the two-day summit represents something of a gamble. The president himself says, though, that keeping the date with Yeltsin is an important signal of what he calls U.S. confidence in Russia's evolving democracy. The Moscow visit begins a six-day trip that also takes Clinton to Ireland, north and south. In Russia, though, the State Duma, Russia's lower house of parliament, began a session this morning at which it was due to debate the confirmation of Viktor Chernomyrdin as prime minister. Chernomyrdin was nominated by President Boris Yeltsin a week ago, but needs the Duma's endorsement to form a government. He's expected to be rejected by the opposition-dominated chamber at the first attempt, the first of three possible votes. The communists and two allied parties, who together account for 212 of the Duma's 450 seats, said on Monday they would vote against Chernomyrdin, who was first sacked as prime minister 5 months ago. North Korea on Monday test-fired a ballistic missile into the waters that divide the Korean Peninsula from Japan, prompting the prime minister to warn that Japan was considering unspecified steps in response. The Japanese prime minister also said Japan knew North Korea was preparing for a missile launch, its first in 5 years. South Korea officials said the missile was a newly developed long-range model. Russian news agencies quoted Russian military officials as saying the missile was faulty and had veered off course. In Washington, a Pentagon official said the Defense Department viewed the launch as a serious development. Sudan has accused the United Nations of spying for the United States. The Sudanese foreign minister said his country became suspicious when a UN plane from Operation Lifeline Sudan had been cleared to land just before the August 20th cruise missile attack on Sudan. But instead, it circled the airport and flew away. Sudanese officials say the plane was conducting surveillance. The government has repeatedly accused the UN of aiding the rebels in the south of Sudan. The Sudan and the U.S. have clashed over the pharmaceutical plant the U.S. destroyed in its missile attack that day. The Clinton administration's story has changed several times since the attack took place. It now seems apparent that Osama bin Laden, the man the U.S. accuses of the bombing in the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, has no direct financial link to the plant, as the U.S. had previously claimed. Other claims made by the U.S. have also not added up, including its insistence that the plant was used solely to manufacture precursors for chemical weapons. It turns out the factory also produces, or does produce, medicine. After 15 days on strike, U.S. West workers have a tentative three-year deal that gives them pay hikes and puts limits on forced overtime. But that doesn't mean to say there's not plenty of overtime waiting for them because of the huge piles of work that accumulated during the strike. U.S. West has backlogs of repairs and installations of all kinds. And customers' patience is apparently running thin. Utility regulators in many of the 13 affected states say they've been besieged with calls complaining about the phone company's service. Meanwhile, the strike by Northwest Airlines pilots is now in its third day. People familiar with the situation say there's little hope for a quick resolution. Talks have broken off. Negotiators for the airline and the pilots' union say they're ready to start talks again, but no sessions have been scheduled. White House officials say that if the strike lasts till Labor Day, President Clinton may reconsider his decision not to intervene. The president could order a 60-day cooling-off period, as he did with the American Airlines pilot strike last year. The major sticking points for Northwest and its pilots are job security and compensation. You're listening to Democracy Now! Here on Pacifica Radio. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman. Amy Goodman, for the last couple of weeks, has been in Nigeria, and earlier this morning we spoke to her about the upcoming elections. She's in Lagos, and this was her report to us just a few minutes ago. We're going to go next to an update from Nigeria from our roving correspondent, Amy Goodman, in whose place I'm sitting here at Democracy Now! These days. We understand that in Nigeria, parties have one more week to register in order to participate in the local elections that will enable them to participate in the presidential elections set for February next year. What does that mean on the ground, Amy? Is there much hustle and bustle about this registration process?
Well, there's no question that a lot of people are organizing. Some parties are forming coalitions with others, and they're so-called registering. That means registering with the military government. The military government determining whether organizations, associations can form parties based on whether they demonstrate national character, that they don't represent just ethnic groups or religious groups. And many people are completely opposed to the military running this process. They say that in order to have a democratic transition, it must be run by civilians, not by the military. And they don't see the regime of Abu Bakr as any different than the regimes before him. In fact, what's pointed out over and over again is that General Abu Bakr was constantly there, a number two and number three man for Sani Abacha, the dictator before Abu Bakr, and before Sani Abacha, he was there for Babangida. And so this is a man who's been in the innermost circle of this brutal military regime for more than a decade. So they do not trust that this is a transition that is leading toward democracy. Let me use the example of Dupe Onitri Abiola. She is one of the wives of Mashood Abiola, who died just a few months ago in custody. Not in the custody of Babangida, not in the custody of Sani Abacha. He died in the custody of Abu Bakr. And he wasn't released when other political prisoners were released. Clearly a tremendous threat to this current regime. Dupe Abiola spoke a few days ago at a rally that was held in a certain part of Lagos. More than 1,000 people came out to this rally, and it was called by the National Conscience Party. That was a party that was founded in 1984 when Sani Abacha ruled out all political parties. He banned political parties. And so Chief Gani Fawahinmi, who is the leading human rights activist in this country, started the National Conscience Party. Now this party is organizing chapters throughout the country, and they're saying, do not participate in this transition. Dupe Abiola, Mashood Abiola's wife, was one of those who spoke, and she said, Abu Bakr is a murderer. He murdered my husband. She is uncompromising in saying that people have to call for, before any kind of election, a sovereign national conference. This is the call that's being put out by pro-democracy activists all over the country. Another person who spoke, and we'll be hearing from him, in fact, next week when we come back from Nigeria, he'll be joining us in the studio, is Aronto Douglas. Aronto Douglas is head of the Chikoko Movement. That is an organization, a pan-Delta movement from the south, the oil-producing region, who called this transition illegitimate. Now, what's very significant about Aronto Douglas and this whole movement is how the minorities in the south, the people who live in the oil-producing region that provide the lifeblood for this regime yet get nothing in return, how marginalized they are. And they are a key part of this call for a sovereign national conference that would bring together the ethnic groups in this country, hundreds of them, the main groups being the Yoruba in the southwest, the Igbo in the east, the House of Fulani in the north, the Ijaws, the fourth largest group in the south, in the Delta, as well as the Ogoni and other minority groups. The Ogoni made famous, of course, by Ken Sarawiwa, who let us all know all over the world about the plight of the Ogoni people and what was happening to them because of Shell. And so all of these various groupings, particularly the minority groupings in the south, are saying, we need a conference where together we can gather as an entire country to restructure the government, to decentralize it, to take the power away from the military, to write a constitution. I just spoke with Chief Ghani Fawahimi, who I was just talking about, founded the National Conscience Party. And he said, how can we even operate? How can we hold elections? How can we function if we don't have a constitution? If the only constitution is one that was secretly written in 1995 under Sunny Abacha, which Abu Bakr has refused to release, so people can't even see what this constitution is all about.
Amy,
and they say the Sovereign National Conference, a conference that would bring together all these people, could also start the process of writing a new constitution.
Let me interrupt you there for just one moment to ask you to clarify for our audience the difference that it makes in Nigeria, that the transition is in the hands of a military government. I think some people listening to the last few weeks of reports that, for example, have come from South Africa, well, Nelson Mandela applauded Abu Bakr as taking steps towards democracy, look at the situation in Nigeria and think, well, if in South Africa you could have had the apartheid regime institute elections that brought about an ANC majority, why are critics like Amy Goodman and others being so critical, so resistant to a comparable process taking place in Nigeria? Tell us the ways in which it is and isn't comparable.
Well, it's not me, Laura. It really is me going around talking with, listening to, going to these rallies, pro-democracy activists here. And I think there's a key difference in South Africa. In fact, in that 1994 election, it wasn't run by the apartheid regime. They had an electoral commission that was set up that the ANC was deeply involved with. Here, it is the military that is running these elections. They have set up something called INEC, which is the Independent National Electoral Commission, which people laugh at. They scoff at it, the idea that it is independent. The people who make it up are chosen by the military. There are people like an Ogoni chief who celebrated the conviction of Ken Sarawiwa and applauded after he was hung. These are the kind of people who make up this electoral commission. And pro-democracy activists around the country say, how can they run an election fairly? The head of INEC, this, quote, independent National Election Commission, came out as soon as he was appointed saying, we won't have religious parties. We won't have ethnic parties. And Chief Ghani Fawahimi, who I was just speaking about, the leading human rights activist, I just went to his chambers to talk to him, was saying, look at Israel, for God's sakes. Their major parties are religious parties. Who is the military to say what constitutes a party and what is not legitimate? What constitutes a party having national character and what doesn't?
I guess that speaks exactly to what I'm getting at, which is, here, I think this is something that you can bring us individually, and you're right, you're reporting on the other people's perspectives on the political movement, but you as an individual there in Nigeria continue to be ruled by a military dictatorship at this point. What is it like? What is the environment in which you find yourself temporarily living, under which Nigerians live 24 hours a day all year round?
Well, there's tremendous repression here that continues. Just a few days ago, I was visiting a women's rights activist. She's one of the leaders of women empowerment, and she is part of a Pan-Yoruba organization that is deciding whether to be a part of the transition. And they went to a large meeting that was held at one of the leading activist houses. And there they recognized people from the SSS. That's the State Secret Service. And one of the things she said, although she's deciding to participate in the transition, is that she feels a little like, and this is a woman who has been arrested, has been detained, has been interrogated by the notorious Nigerian military, she said it feels a little like for a few moments they're opening the door to see who's going to come in, who are the people who are going to surface from below ground to get sort of an assessment of where people are. And then they're going to crack down. And why do people think this? Are they just paranoid? Well, the fact is, for example, Decree Number 2 is still in place. Decree Number 2 being the notorious decree that allows Abu Bakr or any military regime to arrest people and detain them indefinitely, detain them for 6 months, and then extend that for another 6 months, and that can go on for years. We continue to see people, hundreds of people, detained under Decree Number 2. You take the example of Abdul Oro. He's the head of the Civil Liberties Organization. I just went to a news conference there. It's the largest human rights group in Nigeria. It's based in Lagos. And he talked about the problems with the election and this idea of registering parties. Now, Abdul Oro himself, first of all, it was a little hard to hear him holding the news conference because there were carpenters in the office who were hammering the door jams back in because the military had recently raided the offices. This is everyday life in Nigeria. But the other part is this pro-democracy movement that is organizing around this country that has had enough and is also infuriated by the Western industrialized countries, particularly, for example, the United States, that is talking about this notion of the winds of change when you've got, as they say, you know, old wine in a new bottle. A general who presided over the death of Mashoud Abiola, who was there when Ken Sarawiwa was killed, was there when Kudirat Abiola was killed, the wife of Mashoud Abiola. He was there. He was at the center of power, if not the named head of state. And so that's the evidence they have to go on. But people are defiant, and people are standing up.
The resistance is not just taking part in this, taking place in the cities, am I right?
Oh, no question about it. I mean, I think some of the greatest rays of hope are coming from the South, from the most disempowered communities. You'd think they'd be the most empowered because it's where the power is coming from. That's in terms of fuel, the fueling of the regime. This is the oil-producing region of the South, the Delta State, Rivers State, Bayelsa State. This is where the Ogoni live. It's where the Ijaw live and where the oil companies operate. In fact, in Nembe, which is the largest oil well in West Africa, where Shell and Agip, the Italian oil company, operate, their operations have all been shut down by community resistance, community roadblocks, community protests saying you can no longer take this oil from our land and destroy our land and our communities in the process. We demand compensation. We demand some form of autonomy. And they are stopping the operations of these oil wells, something we're not hearing anything about in the West. And one last thing, I think people will find rather interesting, a headline in Friday's TNT, which is Today's News Today, one of the many newspapers that continue to operate in this country because of incredibly defiant pro-democracy activists who are reporters. It's the headline is Arms Dealers Sue Shell, and it's quite a story about the fact that arms dealers in Nigeria are suing the Shell Corporation because Shell ordered weapons, ordered hundreds of guns to give to the Nigerian military to guard their oil wells, to guard their flow stations, to guard their flares. And the arms dealers are angry because Shell didn't pay them. They reneged on their contracts. This is an oil corporation, a multinational corporation, buying weapons for one of the world's most notorious military regimes, now being sued by arms dealers in Nigeria and Britain because they reneged on a contract to pay for weapons. This is a suit that is now being heard in a high court in Nigeria. So if anyone has any illusions about independence of oil companies or the idea that they don't participate in politics, I think they should think again. And I'll just end with the words of Ghani Fawahimi, the leading human rights activist in this country, who we just got a chance to speak with in his chambers, who said that if oil sanctions were imposed, led by the United States, because the United States buys almost half of Nigeria's oil, if oil sanctions were imposed, it would bring down the regime within months. Now, that's something for people to think about. The lifeblood of the regime, that's all it would take. And that takes effort not only of pro-democracy activists in Nigeria, because they're doing a tremendous amount and they risk their lives to do it, but pro-democracy activists outside Nigeria, and he was talking about the United States.
Thank you very much, Amy. Amy Goodman reporting from Lagos. Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, on assignment in Nigeria, sitting in for her. I'm Laura Flanders. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with you in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now!. I'm Laura Flanders. From politics of elections to politics of education, next here on the program. That's the sort of politics that played out in the last few years on campuses in such a way that around the nation you saw campuses convulsed, or some would say revitalized, by student protests on issues ranging from affirmative action to bilingual education to remedial classes. Some would say the struggles have to do with nothing less than the very principle of the public's right to equal education. And as we go to air this morning, students are returning to classes around the country that show signs of the struggles that have gone down in the last few years. Since the passage of Ballot Measure 209, the misleadingly named Civil Rights Initiative, affirmative action in California has been banned at the graduate level, and this spring it went into effect on undergraduate admissions. In New York, conservative politicians pushing to end open admissions persuaded the city council's, the City University's Board of Trustees last session to vote to end remedial education. The programs that have been eliminated at universities disproportionately affect people of color, but they affect everyone concerned about education rights. And here with us now to discuss the present picture on campus as students return and discuss the future and the plans for revitalizing and reaffirming the public's right to education, we have three guests. With us in the studio in New York is Idanis Rodriguez, who is a graduate student at the City University of New York, or CUNY, which he also attended as an undergraduate, and he's been a student organizer there since 1989 and before. In 1989, there was a takeover of a CUNY administration building to protest budget cuts, and the struggles have continued. He'll tell us about that. And on the line from Berkeley, California, we have Genevieve Gonzalez, who is a sophomore at the University of California in Berkeley, and she's a member of the Students of Color Solidarity Council, about which she'll tell us something in just a moment. And with her is Elizabeth Schifrin, who is also at UC Berkeley, a sophomore, and a member of a organizing group that is part of the coalition of which Students of Color Solidarity Council is the leading organization. The group is called Students Organizing for Justice in the Americas, or SOJA. Let's start with you, Genevieve. Tell us a little bit about what, for example, the Students of Color Solidarity Council is and what kind of campaigns you were involved in this last spring. Genevieve Gonzalez.
The Students of Color Solidarity Council is a coalition of student of color and progressive groups on the UC Berkeley campus. And what we've done is we've united these groups on one front to fight our collective struggle, because these attacks on education, the attacks at UC Berkeley, have affected us all. And basically, the things that we've been fighting for are equal access to education, fighting against all of the attacks on education that have been happening in California in recent years, specifically for the past year, affirmative action.
Tell us about the class that's entering now as we speak. How is it different from the class that entered, say, the undergraduate class that entered, say, in 1997?
Out of an incoming class of over 2,000 people, only 376 of these people are underrepresented students of color, which is compared to a figure of 776 people last fall.
So half as many.
There was over a 50% drop in the number of underrepresented students of color this year.
Mm. So as you go to school, as you go to the campus today, does it feel different? Is it sort of tangible, the distinction this year from last?
I would say that there is a definite distinct different feeling. It's not something that you can necessarily see when you walk onto campus because we still have three classes who were fortunate enough to be admitted under affirmative action and including people of color. When you look in specifically freshman spaces such as the dorms or in a lot of introductory classes, you can visually see the difference. But I would say that as far as feelings goes, what we're seeing is a definite shift of who this public university belongs to. It doesn't belong to the people of California. It doesn't belong to people of color. What we're seeing now in practicality terms is that the attacks are coming much more easily. Things that would have been unthinkable to challenge only a couple of years ago are now being threatened. Ward Connerly's most recent attacks are against ethnic study programs and ethnic graduations, which would have been unthinkable only a couple of years ago. But now in the Pro 209 wake, it's very, very, very possible and very, very imminent that those programs will be cut.
Ward Connerly, the chair of the Board of Regents, the person
right.
who really spearheaded the attack on affirmative action. Coming back to New York, Idanis Rodriguez, listening to how Genevieve is describing the class out there, tell us what is going on the New York front here at CUNY, City University of New York.
Well, first of all, I would like to start saying that the student always have a responsibility, as our lawyer used to say, to be the voice of the voiceless. And that's the spirit that I think that all the students should have from California to New York City. And our responsibility is like to continue the struggle of the generation in the 1960s. Definitely that right now in this decade, we don't have the same momentum. We don't have the same motivation for the students to be organized. And we don't have to blame the student because of that. Because the student is only represent one portion of the society. And in the same level that students have to increase the organizations have to happen in the society.
Mm.
In 1989, when we organized the takeovers, it was successful. It was successful that takeovers, and it was only 12 students who organized the takeovers. However, for those 12 days that we spent at City College, we have tremendous support from the community. And the reason why it happened is because in 1989, there was a lot of organizing level outside. We had CSPES organizing. We had a solidarity movement with the struggle in South Africa, Namibia, and also the supporting of Nicaragua. So the level of organization at that time, it was higher than now.
But we've seen protests in the last years at CUNY also when you didn't have the same level of organizing internationally and nationally as you're describing in the 80s.
We have some level organization, however, it was not the same.
Tell us a little bit about what happened on the CUNY campus last year.
Well, students at City College, and the same as CUNY, City University of New York, has experienced a tremendous impact, a negative impact, on the plan that especially the board trustee has been working with, supported by Giuliani and Pataki. It looked that those people doesn't understand that minority people have the right to be educated. And still they don't want to accept that education has to be a right, not a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing right now is basically trying to reduce all possibility that a student has to get into college. Before, when I was accepted at City College, there was a program through remedial courses, through where especially minority people could go to college with a high school diploma. Right now, what the board trustee is going for is like to, last year they take a decision in which they will start a process of abolishing remedial courses. They were supposed to start right now in 1988, eliminating remedial courses from three of the major senior colleges. And the plan is to get at the year 2000 without remedial courses at all.
Now, what the administration and what the mayor says is the purpose of that is to bring up the level of the entering class academically so that students aren't spending, so that the student body hasn't got as many people in it who need so much remedial help and instead has a higher level of academic achievement. Or that's sort of the language that is used. How have you responded to those arguments?
Well, that's the mayor that you refer to, Giuliani, is the same one who has been attacking minority people in all levels. So in my belief, what's happening right now is that the elite, they are afraid of the growing of minority people. And probably they plan, they used to make long-term plan, different from many of our minority organizations. We used to, and also the students are part of the whole movement. We used to like make short-term plan, and the elite, they make long-term plan. And they know if that the growing minority keep the same level as it is right now, 50 years from now, black and Latino, they will, the so-called minority will be majority. So therefore, they don't want to keep the same opportunity that they had when they went to college. Mm. When they went to college, they were free tuition. They didn't have to pay at all. So right now they say, okay, the color people in City University in New York, the same as most public a university in all states in this country, has been increased in relation to minority people. And I don't think that that's something that they would like to see.
Mm-hmm. Coming back to you, Genevieve Gonzalez, you can hear Idanis Rodriguez making connections between different kinds of campaigns and suggesting that there's an overall effort here to rescind the right of education to all people. Do you see connections between the different campaigns that have been launched on different educational issues in California? I'm thinking of around bilingual education as well as around affirmative action. What are the links and connections there as you see them?
Definitely. I would say that what we're witnessing across the nation is that what's happening is that they're taking away the equalizers. At CUNY, we see that it's in remedial classes. In California, we see that it's, you know, on one end affirmative action, on the other end we have millions of school children who are starting school this fall without bilingual education. That's also an equalizer. It helps students get trained, you know, learning in Spanish before they learn in English to make sure that their transition into that is a lot easier. We now have millions of students who aren't going to be able to have that transition. That's also an equalizing force in education. So I think that what we're seeing is definitely trends from coast to coast on attacks on education, specifically in terms of the equalizers that help poor people of color get access to education.
Now, Elizabeth Schifrin with SOGIA, you're listening to two students talk about what they perceive as an attack on students of color and their right to education. How do you perceive this, and how does it affect your rights and your educational experience, the attacks that have come down at UC Berkeley?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think affirmative action is a very emotional issue. It's a very tense issue in itself. There's a lot of people have very strong emotions about it, and it's definitely always been that way. However, when we had affirmative action on the Berkeley campus, what was sort of the message being sent at that time was sort of acknowledging that racism exists in this country, it exists in this state, and we're going to acknowledge that it exists, and we're going to say that we won't tolerate it, and that it will not be tolerated on this campus. And in fact, we're going to develop programs that attempt to demand equal access for everyone. However, since Prop 209 has passed and that program has been taken away, what is being said at this point is, you know, the existence of racism is being denied, and it's the message being sent is that racism does not exist. And I think this is a really dangerous statement because I think it's very invalidating of the experiences of many students. And I think it also perpetuates racist stereotypes. I think, you know, if we look at the over 50% drop in enrollment numbers, and we're saying that racism is not a factor in there, then, you know, what are we saying? Are we saying, okay, well, students of color, underrepresented students of color are inherently less motivated or less intelligent than other students? I mean, that in its very essence is racist. So I think the tension around these kinds of issues has really heightened. I think this campus is not a safe environment for many students to address this issue. I think the message that racism is not okay is not prevalent on this campus any longer. I think it's been very silencing. I think the dialogue between students around this issue has been silenced. I see a lot of white students talking to other white students about these kinds of issues. I think, you know, this is tragic in that a university is supposed to cultivate this kind of discussion.
And you, as a member of SOJA, which is one of the groups that is a part of the coalition led by the Students of Color Solidarity Council, but is not in itself a Students of Color group, how do you see the goals and agenda of SOJA's served in this campaign?
Well, we are a multicultural group, and many of our members have been very involved with the Students of Color Solidarity Council. I think it's very tied in. I think we see it as a common struggle, definitely, because it is an issue that affects all of our education. You know, I don't want to be at a university where I'm taking, like, a Native American studies class with all white students, or I don't want to, as attacks on ethnic studies are increasing, we're looking at the possibility of, you know, Native American history being lumped back into American history, and, you know, could potentially be being taught by white professors, and, you know, this sounds to me more like anthropological study than...
That's not what you signed up for at Berkeley.
Right.
Now, while we're talking about safety, I'd like Genevieve Gonzalez to bring our audience up to date with an issue that was brought to public attention last week thanks to activists on the UC Berkeley campus, and that's the issue of the presence on the campus of a man who witnessed an attack on a 7-year-old girl in the restroom of a Nevada casino. Jury selection actually starts today in the trial for his companion, the man who was accused of murdering this 7-year-old in the restroom in Nevada. 19-year-old Jerry Stromeyer is facing charges of sexually assaulting and then strangling 7-year-old Sherry Iverson. Now, Stromeyer's friend, who witnessed the murder but was not charged, David Cash, was greeted by protests when he returned to UC Berkeley last week, where he's a sophomore in, is it nuclear engineering?
Yes, it is.
What's the issue with this guy on the campus, and does it have an impact on your sense of safety? Is that why you were all out in the streets? What happened last week first?
Well, I think that what we're seeing really with the presence of David Cash on the UC Berkeley campus, after he witnessed the beginnings of, or however he's saying it, the really, really horrendous attack on Sharice Iverson, is that what we're seeing is a very, very clear message sent by the university, by university officials, about who is welcome on this campus. We're not welcoming students of color. We're not welcoming poor people of color. We're not welcoming people who have struggled to get where they're at. Instead, we're welcoming somebody who has very blatantly, even aside from his action, in his words, in his interviews afterwards, has very blatantly stated that he feels no remorse for the child, that he feels no remorse for her family, that he feels no remorse for anything that happened, and that all he needs to worry about is himself. The specifics of the situation are that he was with his friend, and when his friend began to attack Sharice Iverson, and he says that he left, and he says that in leaving, he has no obligation to protect her or to make sure that she wasn't hurt, and she was, in fact, sexually assaulted, strangled, and murdered. And I think that what we're seeing is a very, even aside from issues of safety in terms of people walking the campus with somebody who would take part in such a horrendous act, even aside from those issues of safety, I think what we're seeing is a very, very clear message from the university that we don't have place on this campus for people of color, we don't have place on this campus for poor people, but what we do have a place on this campus for are people who would create such an assault against another human being, and that sort of person is welcome here, while people of color are not. And I think that that's a very clear and very horrendous message that the university is sending that they really can't deny.
Mm. Idonis Rodriguez, here in New York, a graduate student at the City University of New York, what do you see as the possibilities for organizing across the country among students, and what do you know of organizing like that may be taking place this year that's coming up?
Well, I think that there's a lot of possibility of organizing the student movement. And what we got to do is to link the student movement. Right now, in September 5th, there's going to be the Youth Million March, which is a controversy for many people. However, no matter that people agree or not, that's something that is going to happen in New York City on September 5th.
Million Youth March.
The Million
right
Youth
here
March.
In New York.
And therefore, I think that that's something that we have to encourage youngsters to go to that rally. Because I think that's going to be a good opportunity to bring a student from different universities together for their own starting a new semester. We had to to organize the student with those issues related to not only to what happened in the inside the college, but in the campus, but also outside in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And also we had to encourage those people who struggled during the civil rights movement that they had to give something right now, because mm-hmm. we are losing most of the rights that they accomplished.
Elizabeth Schifrin, what's on the books for demonstrations, plans, actions for this coming fall very quickly?
Well, actually, that might be a question you'd like to designate to Genevieve.
Okay. Genevieve, do you have plans for uprisings this fall?
I have definite plans. The struggle is one that will continue for a long, long time to come. I think a very real question to ask is that we recognize that this campus has a history of resistance and activism. Who will be here in 4 years to continue these struggles? And until that time, we need to make sure that we do every effort possible to make sure that we are, as your other guest said, a voice for the voiceless, making sure that the struggle continues, making sure that the actions and that the attacks on education are not tolerated. We won't tolerate them as long as we're here, as long as we're in the community. We will not tolerate them. And I think that the nation will see that in the future months, in the future years, the activism on the Berkeley campus will not subside,
Genevieve,
because we will not be silent.
Genevieve Gonzalez is a sophomore at the University of California, Berkeley, and a member of the Students of Color Solidarity Council. She's been joined on the West Coast by Elizabeth Schifrin, who is another sophomore at UC Berkeley and a member of Students Organizing for Justice in the Americas, or SOJA. With us here in New York is Idanis Rodriguez, who's a graduate student at the City University of New York, also was an undergraduate there. He's also taught high school for many years, right here in New York. Thank you, all three of you, for taking part with us here on this segment of Democracy Now! Stay tuned. We'll be back with you in just 60 seconds. Democracy Now! Here on Pacifica Radio. My name is Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman. We're going to go next from public education to public information via the public airwaves. Yes, they do belong to the public. We help to remind people of that during this segment. The debate continues over the issues of access and control of knowledge via cable and television broadcasting, not to mention radio. As multinational corporations increasingly gobble up media outlets, we've seen an explosion at the same time of creativity on public access TV stations. Public access are those stations that enable local people to air their ideas, produce programs, develop talent pretty much for free at their local cable provider. Cable companies are required under current law to give airtime to the community, and where that takes place, you get public access television. In many other places, the struggle is yet to be fought and won to acquire those stations from the cable companies. In some cases, some notable instances in the past, cable access shows have even had larger audiences than network TV. Well, we'll hear about that in a moment. But there are other times when you tune into cable access or public access and think, what is that? And how did it get on the air? And why are we fighting for this? We're going to talk about all of these issues and more as community access is up for refranchising this season. Now that Westinghouse, CBS, General Electric, NBC, Walt Disney, ABC, and others are taking fewer risks to preserve their audiences, the information that we have access to becomes more and more limited, and public access television becomes more and more crucial, many people say. And we have with us on the line three people who are very involved in public access TV for lots of different reasons. In the studio, Anthony Riddle. He's the executive director of Manhattan Neighborhood Network, one one of the largest public access TV stations in the country. With us on the line from California is Bunny Riedel, who's the executive director of the Alliance for Community Media in Davis, California. And also up very early on the West Coast is Fernando Moreno, who's a producer and organizer with Community Access TV in Portland and has also worked in Albuquerque and elsewhere. Let's start with you, Anthony Riddle. What function does Manhattan Neighborhood Network serve?
Well, we offer a voice for the public in the borough of Manhattan and the city of New York, just like public access centers all around the country do for their own communities. Basically, the cities are in a position where we have the public right-of-ways which the cable lines are laid, and we trade these both for money, for channel time, and for support of the public access centers so that the people have a means of communicating with each other in the community over the cable stations.
Now, you say that you do that. It was a struggle to get that arrangement set up. Give us a quick kind of nutshell version of how this happened.
Well, federal law allows the cities to charge for the public right-of-ways, and they can charge, like I said, money, which is a very important thing to cities. But I think even more important is the ability for the community to use these channels to communicate with each other, to be able to form a sense of identity. And this is not an easy struggle. We're in the middle of franchise renegotiation right now, which means that the contract between the city and the cable company is being renegotiated. And none of these things that are in the original franchises, namely the channel space and the support for public access, are a given. So as in all these matters, you either have to have money or people to get your way. And so we really try and organize the community to protect and understand the service.
Now let's go slow here for people that aren't familiar with all these terms, franchise agreements and all of this. People need to be reminded that the public airwaves belong to the people under early legislation from the 1930s.
Exactly.
And the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, grants commercial people the right to use the airwaves to run their programming in exchange for certain things. And you're saying that public access cable, public access TV is one of those things that in some places cable companies have been made to give up in exchange for their commercial rights.
Well,
is that right?
Yeah, I mean, just taking New York as an example, the two cable companies in New York are, make about $1 billion a year, and I'm not exaggerating, $1 billion a year, just operating in New York City. So there's vast amounts of money to be made on a public property. It's your property, you own it, whether you're a taxpayer, a cable subscriber, or a homeless person in the city, you own this property. And so in order for these companies to make money off of your property, they have to give something in return, which is actually something really valuable, which is a voice for the people.
Well, let's talk about how valuable it is. Fernando Moreno, speaking to us from Portland, what is the value of public access TV as you see it?
Well, there is, in my mind, and based on the work that I do, is community development. And we work with many groups in this area to affect the community, to make changes that are positive, to educate the community at large about issues that are important to the community at this time. And of course, you also see programming that reflects the community, and those are the programs that you go, what is this?
Tell us a little bit about the kind of programming you've been involved in to give people an idea.
Well, I'm a community media practitioner, meaning that I work with local individuals and groups in a number of projects. The latest project that I got involved last Friday is with the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition in the Portland area, and these people are hoping to educate the community at large about issues of energy, electricity deregulation coming up next year. So their goal is to educate the community at large. Again, they're going to produce videos for this purpose, and they're going to do studio productions in order to have call-in programs so that people can ask these questions. But most important, they're going to use these videos for people to use in their neighborhood and invite people to their living room, show the video, and have a discussion about what it means. Why are we going to do what you do is not important. It's as long as you're informed, that's the goal.
Mm. So you're really exploiting or using not just the on-air capability, but the studio space that provides you the opportunity to make documentaries that may air on the network, on the station, but also get used in the streets.
In the street and in people's living rooms. Mm-hmm. This is more important than, this is as important as watching it on the channel, because people need to talk on face-to-face. They they have to have that two-way communication.
Bonnie Rydell from Alliance for Community Media in Davis, California. Is that kind of how you use public access TV?
We're in D.C. We're a national organization, and what we do is represent the public educational and government access centers around the country, which are not just television, but also radio and sometimes internet service provision to the community. And what we do is, like I said, is represent people like Tony Riddle or Fernando to make sure that these rights of way are secured, that the electronic green space for access is secured. And it's, and as Tony pointed out, it's not easy.
So let's clarify. So the Alliance for Community Media is actually a coalition that works for community access television around the country.
Yes, right, exactly.
What are some of the legal issues that you're up against that you fight around?
Well, the records are mixed, and as Tony was saying, you know, it depends upon the franchise agreements in the various communities. Some of them are really good. We have good municipal cooperation in cities and counties around the country. And then some of them, you know, we're battling not just the municipalities, but also the cable operators themselves. They don't want to give up that channel capacity, because if all they do is run infomercials all day, they're going to make money on that channel, which they're having to give up to public access. And there are plenty of times that it's resented that, you know, public access is even there, or government access or education access. But the beauty of it, it is really the people's media. It is where people can actively participate in media rather than just being passive recipients of media. And also the beauty of it for the educational and informational value of it is that it allows people to see their local city council or county council meetings. Maybe they wouldn't be able to go down and see them. It comes right into their living room. They can keep an eye on what's going on, or to get kinds of education that would not necessarily play well on mainstream media, but also then to produce programming. And this is especially important for disenfranchised communities, as I think most of us understand that mainstream media does not represent America. And this is something where disenfranchised communities can come out and have a voice in media and talk to the community and maybe dispel mythologies perhaps surrounding those disenfranchised communities. So it's really, it's exciting stuff. It is democracy at its best.
Now, I said that refranchising is taking place around the country. What does that mean, and what challenges are you up against specifically right now?
Well, there were a lot of the franchise agreements were put in place in the early 1980s, and some of them were 10-year or 15-year franchise agreements, and those are up for grabs all over again, and it's up to the local community to make sure that this valuable media is preserved for the local community. It's also really up to a lot of times the municipalities to say very firmly to the cable operators, as Tony was saying, it's $1 billion worth of sales there in New York. It's real important for the municipalities to say to the cable operators, well, you're going to come in through our community, lay your cable through our backyards or across our streets or whatever, and you have got to, as responsible corporate citizens, give back to these communities. It's like I said, it's around the country, it's very, very mixed. For instance, I'll tell you, in Philadelphia, the land of liberty, they don't have access. And that's really a shame. All that money that they're getting from the franchise agreement goes directly to the municipality to be spent through the general fund. And we see that in communities around the country. Some places are really great, and some places are not so great. So that's what we're working for.
Anthony Riddle, what makes the difference between a community that's really great and one that doesn't in this respect of community access television?
Well, you know, I've seen a lot of them across the country, and it's not just the size, but, you know, but does that access center fill the needs of the community? I've seen some that run for as little as $30,000 a year in very, very small communities. But this is the most important form of media for those communities which don't have major media to cover what's going on. You know, if I could just say for 1 second, you know, why this is really important. You know, you look at the mergers of media right now. Time Warner, which is not a bad company here in New York, actually owns outright about 14 of the channels that are on their cable system, and God knows, you know, who's married to who in ownership these days. So, you know, in looking at why I was involved, I began to realize, I don't know if you've heard of Juneteenth celebration. But Juneteenth is the June 19th day where at Galveston, Texas, the slaves found out that they had been freed on paper by Abraham Lincoln 2.5 years before. So it meant 2.5 years people died slaves that should have been that should have had a few moments of freedom. People were born slaves that should have been born free, and people worked for 2.5 years under a system which chose not to give them the information they needed to be free people. So if you're going to talk about democracy, not just in America, but around the world, the number one thing that you've got to have is free access to information. Doesn't mean that everything that's on access is good, but you do have to have these open lines. You know, it's critical as to whether our children are going to be slaves in the information age without chains except around their minds.
All right, you asked for it. I'm going to have to say, I'll come out and say I'm a supporter of public access TV, all right. But it is true that sometimes you turn on those stations and you see programming and you just think, what on earth is this doing on the air? Is it unedited, completely free access? What standards are used to decide who's going to get on the air and who isn't?
Well, that's the whole point. We don't decide who goes on the air. You know, the people you see, those are the people in your community. You don't like everybody in your community. You know, you don't have to watch the Albanian program we show here, for instance, but this is a major program that's being used to organize the people in Kosovo. So
I just mean that there's some programming that people do find offensive, that either sounds racist or sounds anti-Semitic, or, you know, it sounds offensive to people, and I'm trying to get you to articulate, you know, what are the purpose of programming for people that maybe have had that experience and don't get why they should care about public access.
Well, we certainly don't live up to Fox's Most Dangerous Car Crashes That Ruin Families Part 5 or anything like that. But we do really believe that there's a collective unconscious, that somehow you have to allow the people to be able to speak their mind, and that it's better for you to hear these things and to know that these people are in the community so that you can initiate a dialogue rather than to try to silence people, because who are we to decide? You know, you can have people standing at the gate on all the other channels. These are the channels where nobody stands at the gate, and that you see yourself as you are. Good, bad, and ugly.
Fernando Moreno, do you want to come in on that question?
What we're doing is we're encouraging debate and conversation in our community, which is a valve. It's almost like an escape valve for people, for a lot of people here, and people that want to express their points of views. People obviously have the choice to listen or not to listen, just like they are confronted in the street with people and different ideas. That is the community. There is also the large sector of programming that is very interesting. It may not be polished, but carries a very, very interesting program or message to the community. You have to view these channels also, or the ability to have access to these channels, as basically what the community gets in exchange for large contracts. A contract of 10 to 15 years that a cable company will make with a city is one of the largest contracts that city will sign in that period. And so you're talking about billions of dollars. And what are these communities, what are these companies going to give in exchange for the use of public space in order to lay that cable and the right to use those channels? And so these are very important franchises, just like electricity and telephone and all that.
Another question here is that in most of the cities that we're talking about, there's only one cable provider, and it amounts essentially to a kind of monopoly. To make that $1 billion that Anthony Riddle talked about. How about that aspect of this, that it's a counter-monopoly action? Fernando.
Well, this is another argument for these companies offering this service. That's one of the things. Not only do they get you to use our public space, but they also get a virtual monopoly in most communities. Because let's face it, even if there is competition, which in many cities there is, it tends to be very tiny. This competition has been opened at a time where these cable companies had large numbers of customers, and people doesn't switch. In the last few years, we have seen how direct television and so on has not affected very much the business of cable companies.
Finally, one last question to each one of you, maybe just a point here. Why should people be active now, or should they, around this refranchising question? And if they want to be, what can they do? Let's start with you, Fernando, and come to Bunny Rydell.
Well, generally, every city has a cable regulatory office or a cable commission, and that's where people call in. Those are the people protecting the rights of the consumer, if they are cable subscribers, or any citizen. They basically are regulating the use of the public right away. That's the people that they should contact and ask them, what have you done? What kind of deal are you going to obtain so that we can have adequate access to community? Is it based on community needs? Have you done a study? And then if so, are you applying those to your contract? Have you contracted the best people possible to negotiate this contract for us? And that is key. If people are not able to negotiate good contracts, they will not have meaningful access.
Thanks, Fernando. Bonnie Rydell is the Executive Director of the Alliance for Community Media. If people want to contact you for more information, they can find you in the DC phone book?
Yes, they can.
Thank you very much. And with us in the studio, Anthony Riddle, Executive Director of Manhattan Neighborhood Network, up for refranchising this fall. Thank you, all three of you, very much for being with us here on Democracy Now! That's it for the program today. If you have comments or questions, you can call 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. You can also find Democracy Now! On the web via the Pacifica webpage, which is www.pacifica.org. The program has been produced by Zachary Fink and Janice K. Bryant. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. From the studios of BAI in New York, I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!